This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Joy 94.9.
Freshly dug Joycast.
And this is Doug Pollard. This hour, of course, as always, we have a special guest whom we go one-on-one with for a full hour today. We have Stephen Jolly, who joins me now in the studio. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Doug.
Now, tell people who you are.
Well, I'm a councillor in the city of Yarra. I'm the only socialist councillor elected in Australia, well, at least since, I don't know, World War II or something like that. And I've been...
A rare bird indeed, then.
Yeah, yeah, you know, a rose amongst thorns, I'd say. But
especially
if you look at Yarra Council councillors. But I've been a political activist since I was 18 in South Africa, Zimbabwe, you know, China, here, the UK. But I've got sort of a bit respectable in the last few years and got elected by mistake onto the council. So I'm looking after dog poo and dodgy trees that are messing up the foundations of, you know, people's houses. But I'm pretty much... relatively prominent activist in this city and have been for some time.
Well, you made a bit of a splash during the election. You got a fair old vote there in Richmond, didn't you, when you stood for the parliament here?
Yeah, well, look, we were really pleased with it. I doubled my vote and got the highest vote for a socialist candidate in Australia in a state election for a hell of a long time. And, votes that we got were, like, I got mainly from public housing tenants and people in my ward where we've worked really hard to sort of make... The socialists were not as scary as people might first think.
Yeah, we got a bit scared of the word socialist in recent years, haven't we? And as I say, you're a pretty rare bird that you actually happily wear that badge. You know, there are some people probably in the Labour Party who still think of themselves as socialist. I don't suppose they really are anymore. But you're one of those people who's committed to making a difference, which is one reason why I wanted to talk to you on the programme. But what I want to do is start back right at the beginning... where you originally come from and what the roots are of this activism and this commitment. And we'll do that in just a moment, because what we always do on this segment of the program is we start with a piece of music and then we kick off from there about why you chose that, and then away we go. Now, your first piece of music is from Thin Lizzy. This takes me back a bit. It's called Jailbreak. Why did you pick this one?
Well, anyone who lived in Ireland in the 1970s, where the Catholic Church was like the theocracy, where there was no abortion, no contraceptives, no divorce, and let alone the issues for LGBTI people, it was a horrific theocracy. Everybody wanted to get out of there, and I felt like an outsider living there. I lived in a public housing state in Ireland from 0 till 14, and Thin Lizzy at that stage were the only thing that ever came out of Ireland that was famous. I was the only black guy in Dublin, so he was always a bit weird. Phil Lynott, who's obviously passed away a few years later. And for me, all I wanted to do was get out of that hellhole. That's how I looked at it. And
Jailbreak is the song that says it for you.
Exactly.
Okay, Thin Lizzy, Jailbreak. And this is Doug Pollard bringing it to you this hour, digging deeper with Councillor Stephen Jolly. Now, that was Thin Lizzy there, Jailbreak, emblematic of Stephen's wish to escape from a theocratic Ireland. Let's go right back to the beginning. You said before we played that you lived in Ireland from year 0 to 14, I think was
That's right,
what you said. Let's begin at the beginning. Whereabouts were you born?
Well, I was born in London, actually. My mum and her two sisters were living in a house where their father basically molested them. Mm-hmm. My mother ran away from home in early 1960s to London. Mm-hmm. At a time when it was hard being a single mum or a single woman, especially an Irish woman. There used to be signs up, if you want to rent here, no dogs, Irish or blacks need apply.
Mm-hmm.
So she got pregnant very quickly, and... the guy just sort of basically buggered off, and she had me in London. Her mum came over, took me off her, and brought me back to Ireland. I was a couple of days old, and I was brought up, as I said before, in a public housing estate in Dublin, and I was told that my mother was actually my sister.
Mm-hmm.
So for the first 14 years of my life, I just thought I was the sixth kid, and the other five were a little bit older than me.
Mm-hmm.
Three sisters and a couple of brothers, and... that was life for me. I just lived on this sort of public housing estate, went to the government school in Ireland, and sometimes went to visit my sister stroke mother, but thinking she was my sister over in Ireland. And it was at a time when obviously Ireland was in a low-level civil war in the north of Ireland,
mm-hmm.
In the 70s. It was very political. And that obviously, got me very, very political. My grandfather, the guy who was the abuser, actually, who I didn't know this until years later, what he was doing, he had fought in the Spanish Civil War for the fascists.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was very political, obviously, from a right-wing perspective. So yes. I had a very, very weird political background.
Boy, you did, didn't you?
And so when I was 14, I went to visit my mum, who had since got married and had two more boys and moved to South Africa under apartheid. And I went there and she had a swimming pool and a maid and was living the high life, and she said, listen, I'm actually your mum, do you want to live with me? And I'm thinking, shit, you know, it's warm, we've got a swimming pool, we've got a maid, a gardener. So I moved at the age of 14 from this shithole in Ireland to this basically upper middle class existence in South Africa.
That's a huge jump, isn't it? I mean, it sounds like it was a very poor life in Ireland.
My grandmother, who brought me up, was an amazing woman. I mean, she lived her life in denial, of what her husband was up to. That was a tragedy, but she was a fantastic to me. She gave me a lot of confidence and maybe too much confidence, actually. She passed away maybe 10 years ago, but so I don't regret that background and those experiences, but they were tough, and they've toughened me up a bit. And then South Africa in a different way was a very politicizing experience.
Well, let's stick with Ireland for a moment. Where you said it was like a theocracy at the time, that the church had a stranglehold on the country. Did you feel that sort of like in everyday life? In what sort of ways did it impact on you?
Well, every single person, literally every single person, went to Mass on a Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
Every day the priest would come around with the envelope, every week I should say, and give it to my mum, and we would have to put it, hopefully a note in it to mm-hmm. go back to the priest. By the way, the priests, most of them at the same time, were touching up all the kids in the area, all the altar boys and girls and whatever. But we had a situation where, there was no abortion, no contraceptives, no divorce. People were trapped in unhappy relationships. People who were gay, for example, either lived single or got married in unhappy relationships. There was loads of domestic violence. When my sister, for example, my auntie, got pregnant once, she had to get a backstreet abortion because we couldn't afford to send her to the UK for a proper abortion. Obviously, abortion was banned.
Mm-hmm.
So, look, there was a lot of joy and happiness in Ireland at the time. But, to be honest with you, the Catholic Church made life absolutely miserable for most people. Plus, on top of that, the other overlay was that you had a low-level civil war going on in the north of Ireland, which occasionally spilled over into Dublin with car bombs and so on.
Mm.
So it was a very, very interesting times, but I think...
And because the Civil War was going on and because there was this stark differentiation being made between Protestant North, Catholic South, that must have in some respects reinforced the theocracy.
Absolutely.
Because it was part of like being Southern Irish, wasn't it? It was part of the Irish identity.
Yeah, that's right. It was only afterwards that I thought it was weird that the state would have an official religion. I mean, we all laugh about Iran today and some of the Middle Eastern countries, and correctly so, and criticize them for where religion, Islamic religion, is dominant on the state. But it happens in so-called Christian countries too, or it did in Ireland.
Mm.
And it's no wonder that in the 80s and 90s, there was this massive reaction, mainly from young people, against the Catholic Church. And Christian brothers and priests and nuns in Ireland amongst young people are absolutely hated and despised because of what they got up to over the course of 100 odd years. I'm not saying that everybody who, took the cloth was like that, but there was some amazing people who did that, but there was some real rotten eggs in there too.
Did you actually personally experience any of that?
No, I was very lucky. I got physical abuse at school, the leather and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But I was never, unless it's deeply repressed, not that I can remember that I was actually...
I think you'd remember.
Yeah, I think so.
And I'm not too keen on this repressed memory thing myself.
Yeah,
no, I think if you were, you'd know.
Yeah, it gets a bit overplayed.
I know a lot of people say, it never did me any harm. You obviously sort of came out and through, so to speak. But I don't think it helps much either.
Yeah, if you go through a horrific experience and survive, it's not a question of saying, it's not, I survived, so therefore it's okay. It's, I'm lucky I survived. Mm-hmm. For a lot of people didn't survive.
Hmm.
My natural mother...
Yeah, it doesn't toughen everybody. It destroys.
And her sisters, they're really messed up to this day. They've actually just won a court case in Ireland against the Catholic Church for the abuse that they received in church. Not only do they suffer abuse, as I said before, from their father, my grandfather, but also from nuns, physical abuse, and that's affected their self-confidence to this day.
Hmm. Hmm. So it must have been like a vision from heaven, so to speak, when suddenly you were presented with South Africa and a swimming pool and servants and the white lifestyle that they had out there. Oh,
absolutely. And also, because I had a bit of an accent, you know, all the girls thought that was pretty cute. And I sort of, you know, played that up a bit. So I had a great time there. And I'm sort of, I was into sport, and I still am into sport. And, you know, for white people, it was just an amazing lifestyle. It was heaven on earth. And, you know, for the first few years there, before I started waking up to what was going on around me, that I was in this little island of prosperity in an ocean of poverty and repression and racism. But as a 14-year-old, you don't think like that, of course. It was just a fantastic. I mean, it was pretty tough at the school. I mean, we had military training. We were all getting ready to go into the army. The violence against the kids in the school, the corporal punishment, was actually even tougher than Ireland. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it wasn't as bad because you didn't have this guilt thing that you had in Ireland. And, and obviously the sun, the weather, you know, the lifestyle was just, you know, light years ahead of what I was experiencing. So I had an absolute ball as a teenager in South Africa.
It's just an amazing kind of change of life from the one to the other. As I said, it must have seemed like heaven when you first got there before you twigged to the political situation.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, my mum was very keen for me to stay and not go back with her mother. So she really laid it on thick. Mm-hmm. So I was spoiled silly. And it was just nice to connect with my two. I thought they were my nephews, but they're actually my two half-brothers, David and Danny, mm-hmm. who I actually caught up again for the first time for 28 years at the recent World Cup in South Africa. But, you know, I've got a really close relationship with them. And that was just a marvelous time in those years.
Okay, time, I think, for another piece of music. And you've picked out X-Ray Specs, Bondage?
Yeah, look, in South Africa, all life was honey and roses. And then in the late 70s, you know, black South Africans started to rise up. Mm-hmm. And sort of, I suppose, some white kids got really shocked by that. And then, you know, the music we listened to was really bland, mainstream, John Travolta, mm-hmm. you know, really horrific stuff, boring stuff, I should say. And then all of a sudden in the late 70s, punk music came on the scene. And I remember listening to this song somebody posted to me from Ireland. Mm-hmm. And it was this young woman. She was about 15 years old, and she was in a sort of a male-dominated punk scene, and she sang this full-on song. It was not many punk songs actually have saxophone in it. And punk music sort of began to wake me up to mm-hmm. the fact that life wasn't all honey and roses for everybody. And that's what this song represents for me.
Okay, X-Ray Specs, Bondage up yours.
Some people think little girls should be seen and not heard, but I think, oh, Bondage up yours! 1, 2, 3, 4!
This is Doug Pollard, digging deeper this hour with Councillor Stephen Jolly, who narrowly escaped, I think is probably the right word, getting into Parliament at the last election. We were talking about his time living in South Africa when apartheid started to really sort of, really started to come apart, I suppose, for the first time, because there'd been uprisings before. Black people had fought back against the white minority before. But at this time we're talking about, what sort of era are we talking about here?
Late 70s, late very 70s. Early 80s, yeah.
This is the time when it really started to break, isn't it? And that coincided with your radicalisation.
After Mandela was jailed, there was a sort of a real repressive period for a decade or two. But in 76, you had the Soweto uprising, and in the late 70s, you saw the development of the independent black trade unions, the student movement, and huge demonstrations all over the place. And that was the time I left school. I'd gone to UCT, University of Cape Town, studying political science. And I started going out with a woman who was not white. And I didn't think much of that, but at the time, that was illegal. The Sexual Relations Act was an apartheid piece of legislation that said that you can't have sex with somebody of a different race. And there's nothing that politicizes a 18-year-old male than when the government tries to interfere in their sex life. And that's exactly what they're trying to do. So that really... I really began to. It was the first time I'd been impacted negatively by apartheid. Up until then, apartheid had been fantastic for me, you know. Mm-hmm. That plus just seeing all of these people putting themselves, you know, in danger to try and change the world. It really brought back a lot of memories from when I was in Ireland and what I'd seen back there. And I slowly but surely mm-hmm. I had an intellectual interest. What was going to start reading, started talking to people, and slowly but surely started getting involved in the movement.
So when you were at school and living the high life, you didn't have many black friends, I take it.
No.
They were on the other side of the wall, so to speak.
No, absolutely. I mean, apartheid was the physical separation of black and white. All the schools were white only. Certain jobs were kept aside for whites. The only black people I would meet would be people who worked in shops, servants, gardeners, and so on. And, you know, it was the most horrific form of society in the modern era. And really.
So, how come you ended up with a non-white girlfriend?
Well, because in Cape Town, it was always slightly more liberal of a city. So, I was involved. I actually was involved in South Africa's first punk band, Red Army, which was also Africa's worst ever band. We played at this nightclub called Scratch, which was the only non-racial nightclub, because all the nightclubs were either black or white, but there was one that was multiracial. So I met this one. I actually thought she was white when I first met her, to be honest with you. But
You had these ridiculous classification system, didn't you? White and coloured.
Yeah, there was four categories. The bottom was Africans.
Mm-hmm.
The second from the bottom was coloured, so mixed race, stroke Indians.
Mm.
The second highest was Japanese, Asian, mm-hmm. and the top were whites, Europeans, which I was in. She was in, I suppose, category three. And when I went to visit her house, and she was actually lighter than all her siblings and parents,
mm-hmm.
and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it didn't worry me, but I mean, obviously, it worried the state. And
so she could pass as white,
yeah,
and that's why you didn't get any immediate reaction to your relationship.
Yeah, I don't think my mum was too happy, although she's embarrassed to say that today. you know, at the time she warned me about the dangers of Nelson Mandela, who was at jail at the time, and what he would do if he took over the country. Now she's literally got a statue of Nelson Mandela next to the Virgin Mary on her lounge room table. When I reminded her of what she told me 20, 30 years ago, she went, "Oh, I didn't say that," but of course she did. But
yeah.
The white people love Mandela now, I've got to tell you.
So you got yourself a coloured girlfriend.
Yeah, and
That was really the thing that radicalised you, or started to, because you started to wonder why on earth the government got anything to do with this.
Also, there was a big rugby team, the British and Irish Lions, broke the sports boycott, came to South Africa, and a lot of protests against it. But one of my relatives was in the team, Tony Ward. He was the number 10, the fly half for Ireland in the British Lions team. And I interviewed him, because mm-hmm. I was president of the radio station at UCT.
Mm.
And all the black and coloured students nearly wanted to kill me, because I'd interviewed somebody who'd broken the sports boycott. And then for the first time again, I realised that people had a political interest that interfered in one's personal life, and it really shocked me, and it made me intellectually curious, I suppose. But because I'd lived in a poor background, I related to these kids a lot more than I related to the kids that I went to school with in South Africa, who were rich and white and middle class. Mm-hmm. And actually the coloured and black students were actually more of where I was used to from 0 to 14 back in Ireland. So all of those things came together. And in very, very late 1981, I decided I had to get out of the country. Plus, I was pushed a little bit. And I left Ireland and went back to left South Africa rather, and went back to Ireland in Boxing Day, 1981, and I didn't go back for 28 years.
So you didn't get actively involved in politics in South Africa.
Yeah, I was involved in protests on campus, but I was very much, you know, just a kid, a peripheral element, and
mm-hmm.
I wasn't involved to the degree that I became later. When I went back to South
Africa, because when you said you were pushed, was that family pressure?
Well, a little bit of family pressure, but also I had some problems with the government because of the Sexual Relations Act.
Mm.
And also, there was also a pull factor. I really wanted to get out of that joint and see the world. And I suppose those three things combined meant that I saved the money up and, you know, flew out back to Ireland in late 81.
Mm-hmm. And what did you find when you got there?
Well, you know, Ireland was in recession, Europe was in recession, Maggie Thatcher was running the UK, the place was in uproar, you know, but it was dead exciting, you know. So I left Ireland very quickly. I worked in a pub in Ireland, went over to England and got involved in politics. I joined the Labour Party, joined the militant tendency inside the Labour Party, and worked with their South African wing, which were in exile in mm. London. So I was given a false passport, a false name. I did some underground work in Zimbabwe. And in South Africa in the early 80s, my name was Anton. On my 21st birthday, all my presents are Dear Anton. And so I was just a frenzy of political activity. You know, every Wednesday, because the South Africans used to send parcel bombs to all the political activist headquarters. So I was just telling somebody the other day that every Wednesday was my turn, that whenever any parcel came, somebody had to open it. So you'd go down into the basement, and always on bloody Wednesdays, there was always parcels. And because they killed up Ruth First and various other activists that were in exile through parcel bombs. So I was like 20 years old at the time, and it's only later when I look back, I think it was a bizarre existence, you know.
When you say you worked undercover, what did that involve doing, if you can talk about it?
Well, I can now, obviously, but I mean, at the time, the apartheid state was a brutal regime, and they killed and bombed and jailed anyone who opposed their point of view. So in order to organize unions and students and protest movements, you couldn't just walk in like you can in Australia and sell newspapers and have public meetings and petitions and all the rest of it. You'd eventually be arrested.
And we're talking about relatively pre-internet days as well.
Oh, absolutely. So the whole thing was underground. So I had a false name, false passport. You know, my cover was that I was a school teacher. And I would organize.
Was this in Zimbabwe?
This was in Zimbabwe and Botswana and other places where there was lots of South Africans and also Zimbabwean poor. And we would organize, you know, current affairs discussions, which were like a cover for discussing politics, mm-hmm. And organizing, you know, student workers' movements, trade union movements against the regime, both Mugabe regime in Zimbabwe and also the white apartheid state in South Africa.
So you were politicizing these people, you were giving them tools, as it were.
Yeah, they were already politicized. They were already very angry and politicized and wanted to change the system, but it was just organizing them and supporting them. And I had that sort of experience, and I was part of an organization that was able to do that. And
so did they then go back to South Africa, or did they work from whatever country they were in at the time?
Yeah, these are people who created what, you know, became the strongest trade union movement in the world, which is the South African trade union movement, the student movement, and basically overturned and overthrew the apartheid regime in 1994.
So they were coming to places like Zimbabwe and Botswana and so on, and basically getting trained in how to organize.
Yeah, that's right.
And that was your role.
That's correct. And also, we also try to organize people in Zimbabwe themselves against what was quite clearly an increasingly dictatorial regime, which was the Mugabe regime, which had come to power 3 years earlier with great promises, but actually it was obviously just, you know, a bureaucratic caste that was just looking after itself and treated for people very badly. So that was like also part of our operations too. So then in 1983 I went back to the UK.
Mm-hmm.
I was working for the militant, and I realized that even though, you know, I felt I'd done a good job down there, I was actually a first world person. Mm-hmm. And I just enjoyed living in London. Mm-hmm. I met an Australian who'd been a, you know,
You didn't do the sort of totally fall in love with Africa thing.
Not really. No. You know, I think
it was a job rather than an emotional connection.
Look, I love Africa. It's absolutely fantastic. But I just like the nightlife of Europe and Australia, and I like the intellectual discourse that I have with people who I'm used to, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think in Africa it was absolutely amazing place. The people are absolutely amazing, but I was always an outsider.
Mm-hmm.
While in England, in Australia, in Ireland, I don't feel like an outsider. And so I just went back to the UK and continued to be involved, but this time in the UK. The miners' strike was going on at the time. I worked as a typesetter for the Millet newspaper, and I met this absolutely crazy Australian woman who had been a heroin addict and a prostitute in the Gold Coast, and had fled to the UK to try and clean her act up. And I just thought she was the most sophisticated, beautiful, and exotic person I'd ever met. I'd never met an Australian before. And I suppose...
Some introduction.
Yeah. So we used to just go out and in between sort of organizing the revolution, we used to go out and have the most amazing times. And the next song, just to jump ahead, really symbolizes that time for me and debauched nights in London in the early 1980s, you know?
Well, it sounds like a good time to do that. And we will go to this piece of music now. And, yeah, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, Two Tribes. Two Tribes? Two Tribes Go to War.
Well, yeah, I suppose. I didn't see it very political at those days. I was just having a good time, you know?
Okay.
I think you're overanalyzing there, Doug.
Well, you know, with someone like you, I'm inclined to see politics in everything, I think.
Oh, fair enough.
But
that's what my shrink says.
But perhaps on this occasion we're not talking about politics. This is Frankie Goes to Hollywood, Two Tribes.
The air attack warning sounds like...
This is Doug Pollard, digging deeper this hour with Councillor Stephen Jolly. He's a councillor in Yarra. Just reminding me off air that he serves alongside a member of our own community on the council there, Dale Smedley from DTs.
Yeah, Dale's a good friend of mine. He's a councillor down in Richmond, and he's one of the most beautiful human beings I've ever met. He's got a great heart, and he's also very, very funny. And
he is that.
I always make sure I sit next to him in the council meetings, because I've got to tell you, I've done a lot of politics, but nothing has ever been as boring as sitting on a council meeting at Yarra Council. And Dale helps me get through those boring Tuesday nights every month. So thanks, Dale, if you're listening.
So if it's so boring, why do you do it?
I do it because the council meetings are just really the icing on the cake. As a local councillor, you can get loads done. You know, I mean, over the last 6 years, in terms of, you know, making sure we got more childcare, making sure public housing tenants get a voice, making sure we got more appropriate development than would otherwise be the case, and just looking after a million issues, from getting an indoor sports centre or reopening Victoria Park. It's real community politics. It's the lowest level of politics in Australia, you know, and the people in Yarra, I mean, you've got everything from drug dealers, you've got every to millionaires, you've got public housing tenants to really, really rich folk, lots of the artistic community, loads of LGBTI community there as well. And it is really the most, I know it's an overworked word, but it's definitely the most diverse part of the world, and it really keeps you on your toes. And I just love it. I feel so honoured to be a councillor for those people down there.
Because a lot of people say that one of the things that's wrong with Australian politics is that we have too many politicians, that we've got too many layers of government, and that you know, Jeff Kennett was the first one to start slicing out things from the bottom layer and gluing smaller sort of areas together to give us bigger councils. But a lot of people think we haven't gone far enough along those lines. But you sound like you're more in favour of the small-scale stuff.
Well, I mean, I think that if you have, like in Europe, they've got a European Parliament where the politicians get paid a whole heap of money, and they've got massive constituencies, and once in a year you might bump into your local European parliamentarian. Mm-hmm. At a local level, I think councils should be made more powerful. I think we should be, in Australia with local councils, also looking after health, education, and they should be more powerful and get rid of state government. I don't think we need three layers of parliament. Three layers of government in Australia. I think we obviously need a federal government, that goes without saying. But I think local councils are the easiest place for local people to access when they've got an issue. But the problem is they've been, through cost shifting, they've been underfunded systematically. They're actually much less powerful than they are in places like Britain. Mm. I think that's a big mistake.
Mm. Well, yeah, I mean, everybody who works in one particular level of government thinks one of the levels needs to go. I have heard a lot of argument in favour of, scaling back the federal government enormously and giving much more power to the states. I've heard arguments for scaling back local government and giving much more power to the states. I've heard every argument from every particular angle. One of the things that, as an outsider, obviously as a Brit myself who's come to live in Australia, been in nearly 20 years now, one of the things that obviously strikes me when you look at a city like Melbourne is there is no citywide authority. There are a lot of small councils looking after relatively, by English standards anyway, relatively small areas, but you don't have one strategic authority like you do with the GLC in London, for example.
Or in Brisbane.
Or in Brisbane, for example. Would you like to see something like that?
Yeah, I would, but I have to say, Doug, it's not just the structural questions, because even if you did have that central authority, if it was run by the major parties today, they would balls it up just as much as they're ballsing up, you know, the segregated system we have at the moment. The key thing is the fact that in Australia, the two major parties, in my opinion, are like Tweedledum and Tweedledee. They turn off most young people. The Greens are like a lame, anemic alternative. And unlike some places in the world, there really is no major alternative left-wing voice. I mean, the party that I'm in is a very small party, and we've got a certain base in Yarra, but not really major base elsewhere. Mm. So there really isn't like a powerful left-wing voice in, you know, an alternative voice in Australian politics like you have in places like Greece and Germany and Ireland. And I think that's a missing link that we really need to fill.
But isn't the Greens coming along and turning into that force? Because you've got people like Adam Bandt, who started out in the Labour Party, started out from a Marxist perspective, and nowadays get labelled as being, I think the phrase is, a watermelon. It's actually a red with a green skin. You haven't been tempted to go down that route?
No, I think the Greens, I mean, you know, I know it's a cliche, but some of my best friends are in the Greens, but I've got to say they've been hopeless on the local council. I mean, they've basically been in a very powerful position on Yarra Council since 2002. We've had three or four Green mayors. We elected another one two nights ago, and all we've had from them is high rates and a couple of extra bicycle lanes. And the hopes that people had in 02 in Yarra, that when we had the first Green mayor and the first sort of almost majority Green on Yarra Council, majority Green councillors, was that, you know, the world was going to be turned upside down and we're going to have, you know, tremendous changes taking place. Well, that actually hasn't happened. Every time the Greens enter into a coalition with a major party here, Tasmania, overseas, they've sold out their ideas and they've become basically like a prop for one of the major parties. So I think that it's great that people voted Adam in August, because it shows that people are looking for an alternative to the major party system. And I congratulate Adam. He's a mate of mine and all that. But I don't think that the Greens are that third force. They're very middle class. They're very inner city. They don't really have a basis outside of the inner city. And I think that we can do better than the Greens in terms of a third force in Australian politics.
But there's not much sign of them going to your party for that.
No, I'm not
a socialist. Which branch of socialist are you? Because we seem to have lots of little splinter socialist parties.
Well, I suppose you could say there's three types of socialists. There's on the one extreme, the socialism, which is another word for Stalinism, which is what we saw in China, Russia and Eastern Europe. That's obviously not okay. What I stand for. In fact, I was participated in the 1989 Tiananmen Square movement and spoke at those protests to 500,000 people. And then on the other extreme, as you mentioned at the start of this interview, there's people in the Labour Party who are, you know, carrying on the policies of the major party who claim to be socialist. I stand for socialism that actually means representing ordinary working people, democracy. So I'd see myself as a democratic socialist, not a totalitarian socialist, or like the ones in the Labour Party, fake socialists.
Yeah, I had a friend at college who, when I asked him what sort of socialist he was, he actually said, "I'm a crude Stalinist," with the emphasis on crude.
I didn't say I wasn't crude.
I think you can't be Stalinist and not be crude, but you're not that kind of socialist. But it has to be said that there doesn't seem to be... I think you're right. People are looking for a third way of some kind. People are looking for something different from the two major parties. But how do you, if the Greens are not going to be it, how are you going to get that third force, you know, into something powerful within Australia? If you don't do like Adam Bandt and some others have done and sort of put the socialist past aside basically do what used to be called entryism into the Greens.
Because you
say they're too middle class, right? But isn't that putting off working class people like you from getting involved?
No, I think you've got to be honest with people. You've got to say to people what they are. I could get double the vote I got if I didn't use the word socialist and said I was an independent or said I was something warm and fuzzy and so on. Because most of my votes, people think, oh, you're a good bloke, but I can't vote socialist. That's a bit too far for me to go. But the fact is, like a chemist, you've got to label your chemicals correctly. Otherwise, you're going to kill somebody. And same in politics. So if I lose a few votes...
I don't think socialism of your brand is going to kill anybody. But
no, you know what I mean. The point I'm making is that once this country fires up like we're seeing in Europe, you know, obviously, you know, economically we're better than we are in Europe and America at the moment. But once you see an economic change like you've got over there at the moment and there's more movements taking place of young people, students, workers and so on, that leads to the generation of community groups, of activism, and that's when you bring all those groups together into a third force. That's how it happened in places like Germany in the last couple of years.
Any sign of it happening here?
Not in the short term, but I think you know, Australia's in the slipstream of Chinese growth, and you know, we've sort of semi-escaped the global financial crisis, but that's not going to go on indefinitely, and when it does happen, it'll happen very fast. And I suppose the point I'd make, if I can get 10% vote for an open socialist candidate in a gentrified part of Melbourne, can you imagine what those ideas would support that they would generate in more working class parts of Melbourne and Australia? So I suppose I'd say to the union, stop being the ATM for the Labour Party and start creating a new third force that's really going to look after your interests and the interests of everybody in this country rather than those of the major parties.
Okay. So much for the manifesto.
Oh, well, you asked. You
know. I did ask. I did want to hear it. We've not got a huge amount of time left, and you've got two more songs to get in, both of which I'm keen to hear. So let's bring in the next one, which is "Groove Is in the Heart" by D Light. Where's this one sit in your pantheon?
I went to Sydney in '85, and I worked, you know, as a socialist and a Labour Party activist there for some years. But in 1989, I was asked to go to China. When the Tiananmen Square movement was on. And I got involved in that. I saw the massacre. I saw a lot of people being killed. And I spoke to 500,000 people. I was the only Western to speak at Tiananmen Square. It was an extremely traumatic experience. So when I came back to Sydney in the winter of 89, after that, I had post-traumatic stress syndrome, essentially. I was in hospital for a week. And this song I suppose, like the last song, symbolises for me just sort of escaping from politics for a little bit and just partying. I moved to Enmore and just having a really wild time in Sydney in the early part of the 1990s. And, yeah, that's what this song brings back, a lot of really good memories of clubs in Sydney back then.
Okay, D-Light, Grooves in the Heart. And digging deeper this hour with Yarra Councillor Stephen Jolly. Now, before we went to that track, which we faded out because it's immensely long, and you said that was your, like, chilling period after you were in China during Tiananmen Square. Do you want to tell us a little bit about how you got there and what that was like?
Well, I went over there as a journalist for the Socialist newspaper because we wanted to find out firsthand what was going on. And obviously the whole city prior to the massacre, for the couple of months prior to the massacre on the 4th of June 89, was basically in the hands of the people. It was like a city in revolt. Tiananmen Square was just teeming with tents and students fighting for democracy and for a change in China. And as I interviewed them, I entered into many discussions with them. I was invited to speak at the launch of the independent trade union movement that they set up in the Forbidden City right next to Tiananmen Square. Mm. That was 4 days before the massacre. They asked me to speak. I thought it was going to be like 12 people there. Mm. And when I got there, there was 500,000 people. I was there sort of underground.
Yeah.
And next minute, I'm all over the TV, ABC TV, all over the world, because I was the first white guy to speak at the non-Chinese guy to speak at Tiananmen Square. And so my cover was well and truly blown.
If you want to work undercover, it doesn't do to stand up in front of 500,000 people.
So I buggered off to Shanghai for a couple of days and then came back on Saturday morning, the 3rd of June.
Were the authorities sort of keeping an eye on you?
Well, I don't know. I don't think
presumably they do in China.
But in those days, they had much more problems on the hand than Steve Jolly, I've got to tell you. You know, they had the whole country in revolt, or at least Beijing anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So I got back to China, to Beijing, on Saturday morning, the 3rd of June, and that was we weren't to know it at the time, but it was a few hours before the massacre, and I was in the square when at midnight, what I thought were fireworks went off, and that of course was the start of the movement of the troops, the People's Liberation, the so-called People's Liberation Army, into Tiananmen Square, and one of the most horrific massacres in modern history.
Very traumatic.
Well,
for the Chinese people, and also for you personally.
Well, it's not, when you see people getting killed, when you get to see people getting shot, unless you're, a total psychopath, it affects you. And especially when some of those people were people that you know.
And when you could yourself be in the line of fire.
Very, very brave people helped me out and got me out of that place. And I don't know whatever happened to them. I then sort of hung around in Beijing for about a week and managed to bribe my way via taxi to the airport, and one of Bob Hawke's sort of emergency planes that he organized for Australians in China managed to get a Qantas flight out. But it was an amazing experience, because everyone talks about the massacre, but the period prior to the massacre was just the most amazing political experience, to see a whole city, one of the biggest cities on the planet, under the control of the people.
I remember them making that statue that they put in the square, the sort of Statue of Liberty, but with both hands on the torch.
Yes,
and all those sort of things.
But they weren't saying we want to bring back capitalism into China, because they knew that it would be third world capitalism that they got, not the first world capitalism. They were looking for democracy. They were saying some of the socialist stuff is good. We've got better education, health than we had before the 49 revolution. But there's so much corruption and dictatorship and brutality and lack of democracy. We can't live like this anymore. So as I said before, when I came back from Australia...
Was there some hope around then that the government would... take this on board and perhaps make changes?
Some people thought that. I didn't. I thought that they would have to be overthrown to get the type of changes that the people wanted, or alternatively, the government would counterattack and wipe out the people, which is obviously what happened.
Mm.
But the idea that the Chinese government were just going to say, oh yeah, that's a good point, and just sort of make some reforms from the top, Gorbachev style, was never going to happen, because once you lose power in China, governmental power, you lose everything, because the government at that stage controlled the economy. So you couldn't just retreat to the economic front. And they were going to fight to the end, the geriatrics who ran the country at the time.
Mm. Funny thing is, now that things have opened up somewhat and you've got a kind of capitalism taking hold in China, another Tiananmen is, on the one hand, less likely. But on the other hand, if it took place, it might have more chance of making that kind of reformist change.
Yeah, well, you've got, a billion people working in industry. It's the biggest working class on the planet, and they haven't really moved into action. They're super exploited. And when they do, they're going to turn that country upside down. And I think that it's going to have big impacts. including on Australia. But that's sort of the missing factor that's taken, you know, in China right now.
Well, let's leave China and let's get you back to Australia. You had to recover from that experience. And somehow out of all that, you ended up in Melbourne.
Yeah, well, when Jeff Kennett got elected in 92, the Socialist Party in Sydney said, listen, will you go down there and help our branch in Melbourne? I was very happy to do that. And I got involved because there was massive sort of protests against the Kennett government in the 90s with the Richmond Secondary College occupation, which went on for a year. Mm-hmm. And I was a campaign coordinator there. We saved that school. It's now Melbourne Girls College, where my daughter goes now. So it's an irony of history. And during the course of the 90s and this decade, I've been political activist in the city. I've ended up with two kids and... as I said before, got elected in 04 to the Yarra Council, and this is my home now, and I love the city. It's just the most amazing place, and you know, it's not perfect, nowhere is, but it really is. It's just, you know, I've been all over the place, but I like Melbourne more than anywhere.
Now, you've stood for Parliament. You stood for State Parliament.
Yeah, well, in the council election, I came first. I beat the Greens, Labour Party, and everything else. In 02, I got 1% in the state. In 06, I got 5% in the state, and a couple of weeks ago and I got 10%, so it's a steady progression. So I think by the time I'm 130 I might get elected to state parliament, but at a local level, you know, I've got a good bit of support, me and my party have. And
you're not tempted to have a go at the federal senate, for example, where you might be in with a chance?
Yeah, I don't know, you might have given me a good idea there. Got to come and talk to you more often, Doug. You'd be my advisor, you know.
You'd hear the thunder from the right wing. A goddamn socialist in the Senate. Oh, can't have this. Rhubarb, rhubarb. I think you're right. I think there is a looking for a third force. Maybe you're destined to be the spearhead of that third force in Australian politics. Who knows? Because you've had more success than anybody else in breaking through from outside the mainstream, other than the Greens.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that the Socialist Party has been very good at is the rubber hits the road, that we don't just talk about stuff, but we actually implement
it. Do it at the local level.
Yeah, and, you know, whether it's...
A bit like Hezbollah, really, in that sense.
Well, you know, it's, yeah, or the Black Panthers. I mean, I know you're joking, but there is an element of truth, you know, that people will trust you if you can deliver on the small things. How are they going to trust you on the big things if you can't deliver on the small things? That's been a sort of a political motto I've had. And, you know, so a lot of what I do is very, very mundane stuff, but it builds trust.
It does. Well, Stephen, it's been a pleasure talking to you today.
Thank you. And you too.
Didn't realise what an exciting life you'd had. So I'm glad you came and told us all about it. One last piece of music, and then we'll say goodbye. This is
for my gay friends in Collingwood, and my daughter, who's a big Kylie fan. Kylie and Scissor Sisters did this at Glastonbury at the winter of this year. It's an amazing song, but I could only get the original version, which is pretty good anyway. It's by the Scissor Sisters, Any Which Way.
Okay, Stephen Jolly, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.